This is The Guardian.
In Norway, a woman's boyfriend forgets who she is overnight. In Detroit, a man is arrested, but he was never at the crime scene. In Spain, disturbing pictures of young girls have appeared, and no one knows who's behind them. Something strange is happening. A collision between people and artificial intelligence. Discover more in The Guardian series Black Box. Listen to the whole series right now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Let nobody doubt that. We are a great country. We rarely say this because it's not in our British nature.
And frankly, things will get worse before they get better.
Is that a protest flag?
We don't protest. I mean, this is what I do.
And I will revive our party so that we can provide the leadership that our great country needs. Because conservatism has not failed.
Don't look back in anger. I'm afraid we do look back in anger at what the last government left to this government.
I'm Pippa Carrera.
And I'm Kieran Stacey.
You're listening to Politics Weekly Westminster for The Guardian. Well, here we are, Kieran, back after a long month,
More than a month, I think.
Since we did our last podcast.
Back in your front room.
Back in my front room, given it's a Sunday and we've got the curtains closed and the blinds drawn, even though the sun is shining outside.
I know.
I'm sure we'd all enjoy.
It feels like debate night all over again, being in a darkened room with the TV in the corner.
But presumably you're feeling much refreshed after your summer break.
I got a holiday. As did you, right?
I mean,
we, unlike seemingly anyone at the top of politics, actually managed to get some time off. And thank goodness, I don't know, I could have gone straight from that campaign into, you know, another summer of full-on work like Keir Starmer did.
I know, I've been feeling a bit guilty. I came back from my holidays last week. I had a week in France and a week in Spain with family. And I bumped into quite a lot of MPs who had either not had a holiday at all or had had a much curtailed trip away. And they all still had that slightly exhausted, haunted look that they had after the election because they were so knackered. And I did feel a bit guilty, but not that guilty, because I personally believe that it's really important to try and take a bit of a break, that you are likely to be able to see things with a sort of a much clearer perspective when you're not sort of caught up in, you know, the sort of the inner workings of Westminster. And also that you know, we all need time to switch off and read books and hang out with our families. And I think we're better people because of it.
Yeah, I completely agree. It stops you going mad. And I think especially for the Prime Minister, and I think it's a really bad idea not to have any proper break at all. There's always going to be something, right? Something always happens in summer. I understand exactly why Keir Starmer had to come back when the riots were at their peak. But then not to go away afterwards, not to just get that time out, you then set a precedent for summers to come. And he's going to be under pressure every single summer not to have his break for some reason or another. I just don't think it's a good idea.
And particularly when you consider that he and his top team were effectively in campaign mode for years since he took over the party, really. And then the closer they got to a prospective general election, they were in heightened campaign mood. So they haven't had a proper break for ages. And while I think it was the right decision not to go away in the middle of the riots, there was definitely a moment where, you know, we were through them. There was the second half of August, really, where he could have just said, you know what, I'm going to park this. I'm going to go even just to Chequers. If he could have last minute got a cheap flight to Spain or somewhere and spent some time with the family, then I think that probably is.
He didn't do an Angela Rayner.
He didn't.
She went raving in Ibiza, was it?
Unlike her. she was videoed in a, recorded in a DJ booth, wasn't she? In one of these super clubs, 5,000 people there watching her in the DJ booth, giving it large and with the DJ. And I think it was Denise Van Outen who recorded and released the video, which is a bit random. But it's not the first time that Angela Rayner, now the Deputy Prime Minister, has been spotted enjoying herself clubbing. And, you know, I kind of think, well, why the hell not? She's on a holiday. But not everybody seems to have had that response, do they?
Yeah, no, I think Nadine Dorris replied that this was kind of completely out of keeping with the serious high office of state. And it's just kind of...
Well, Nadine Dorris, who of course got into trouble for taking two weeks off to go and film I'm a Celebrity in the Jungle.
Yes, of course.
Lost the whip. not becoming
there wasn't
a senior
though,
minister.
Of course, that's very important.
Yeah, she was eating kangaroo's anus and things instead, wasn't she? So,
and I think it's also been important for us to see a Labour politician enjoying themselves, because we've had so much doom and gloom right over the first few weeks of this Labour government. You know, it's all been about what an awful state the country is in, and we've had almost no sense of enjoying being there in government. Let alone this might be the optimistic place to which we're heading.
And it's been a bit of a theme this summer, hasn't it? In fact, beyond the summer, the sort of miserabilism, this approach that the party's taken, and it's been a sort of a strategy to sort of build this picture of how bad things are. And we saw it in the run-up to the election. We saw it writ large when Rachel Reeves made that statement to the Commons where she said, look, we've all these shocks that we've gone in and things are much worse. All these departments are billions of pounds worse off than we expected. There's serious problems ahead. The £22 billion black hole, I think she said there was. And that sort of rhetoric, that sort of narrative continued over the summer, culminating with this speech by Keir Starmer the beginning of last week in the Downing Street Garden, where he kind of put into words what the government has inferred throughout, which is that not only is it going to be tough, but he actually said, frankly, things will get worse before they get better. And I was very struck when I went back to work last week, having heard that fairly sort of gloomy message in the garden, by actually how alarmed some Labour MPs were in response. This sort of like ripple of anxiety is kind of swept across the party, not least because people have been spending time in their constituencies, talking to local people, and I think recognise that people have put their faith in Labour at a time when actually they don't have much faith in politics generally. Mm. They don't like politicians generally. They don't believe politicians' promises. And despite all of that, they've thought, Labour represents an opportunity for change at the election. And so inevitably they have some expectations that, even if not immediately, things will get better. So it's a bit risky, isn't it?
Yeah, I was there in Downing Street Garden for that speech. And it was a really lovely morning. It was beautiful, kind of 25 degrees. The sun was shining. The garden looked absolutely stunning. It was also full. There were about kind of 80, 90 people there, almost half of whom were journalists, but the other half of whom were people that Keir Starmer had apparently met on the campaign trail. All of them were smiling. They were all obviously people who were happy that Starmer had won, and he was there to kind of speak to them as ordinary people after a Labour victory. And he turned up, and actually he looked fairly bouncy. He looked, healthy and well-rested for everything that we've said. But then he started speaking. I thought the tone was so jarring compared with what the moment that we were actually in, which was, a moment of change and an audience who were receptive to what he had to say. And a moment where he could just say, take a breath and say, we had to give you a very negative message during the campaign for good reasons, but let me now explain to you where we're going and where we hope to get to. And it wasn't that at all. And in fact, from what I'm told, he changed it fairly late to make it even gloomier, because they decided to do some more of this, getting the message out there for the budget to come. Because initially this was going to be a speech given earlier in the summer.
Yeah, it was postponed because of the riots.
And then by the time he gave it, he thought, right, well, I better tell people about the budget to come, so that I set their expectations for that. And that's fine. I think, expectation management is entirely sensible, but it's a little bit short-termist to just think a few months ahead, when actually at some point people are kind of wanting to know where you're going to be in 3-4 years' time.
Yeah. Although when I've spoken to people in Downing Street since the speech and said, oh my goodness, it's all so gloomy and can't you give people some hope? And is this going to, I've had MPs say to me things like, oh, it's going to dent consumer confidence, which is going to be counterproductive because we're relying on growth, or suggesting that it was potentially an electoral problem way before the next election, because of course there's council elections next year and the year after there's elections in Scotland and Wales. But they pushed back quite strongly. I was quite surprised. They said, look, this is all part of our strategy to phase our messaging in response to what we found when we take over. So that speech that Starmer gave in the garden when you were there, on his podium, there was the words fix the foundations, very Brownite, really.
Yeah.
And that's the first stage. That's them sort of coming in and saying, look, we need to repair the damage, in their terms, that the Conservatives have done to the country. And that's going to take some time. And then they'll presumably get on to, rebuilding the foundations and then eventually at some point, I suppose they'll produce the, you know, the actual result.
Spending the dividends of growth or something
like that. Something like that, probably. And the comparison that people give is the Blairite one. And I think what's quite interesting, though, is that on surface level, it's very easy to say, well, you know, Tony Blair came in 1997 and it was all sort of buoyant and hopeful and everyone was very excited about everything and upbeat and full of hope. But actually, I think what they forget is that in 1997, the Labour government stuck to Tory spending plans for 2 years.
Yeah.
It also had promises about not putting up income tax in that case. Obviously, Labour now has got promises not to put up taxes on working people. And the economic backdrop, of course, was very different then. It was much better than it is now. But it wasn't all brilliant back in 1997 either. And they did have to spend a couple of years being actually quite rigid with their response, their economic response, before they got on to, you know, rebuilding schools and hospitals and so on. And that's the parallel that the current administration, not the sort of like, you know, hopeful, cool Britannia, but actually the sort of fact that they did have to be quite careful. Also, Keir Starmer just doesn't have the sort of quite the political skill, I think, of Tony Blair then, or even actually David Cameron when he took over in 2010, who seemed to be able to deliver quite serious, grave messages with a twinkle in his eye.
Mm. I've got a quote for you.
Oh my goodness.
All right. Here I came into politics, this person said, because I love this country. I think its best days still lie ahead, and I believe deeply in public service. And I think the service our country needs right now is to face up to our really big challenges, to confront our problems, to take difficult decisions, to lead people through these difficult decisions so that together we can reach better times ahead.
Well, I would instinctively say Keir Starmer or Rachel Reeves, but I guess that actually it's somebody from 1997, is it?
No, it is David Cameron.
Oh, really?
That
2010?
Is what he said interesting. After he came to power in 2010. In fact, immediately after they'd formed the coalition government. And it's a really, I just went back to have a look at that speech because it's a really interesting one. And it reminded me when you mentioned David Cameron, because what he was good at and what he and George Osborne jointly were good at is that Osborne could always do the kind of austerity chancellor thing. And then David Cameron, you know, people used to criticize him by saying he was more a chair of the board than a chief executive. Mm. But actually, he was really good at that role, just kind of giving a bit of a vision, you know, painting in broad brush strokes, sprinkling a bit of optimism among the doom and gloom. And actually, I thought that was a really well-crafted paragraph, because what it says to people is, yes, we're doing these really tough things, but there is a reason. We're trying to get somewhere. And I think that's the problem that Starmer and Reeves have at the moment. And they're both, as you say, it's in their character for both of them to you know, be very serious and focus a lot on the difficult things they're trying to do. But unless they tell people why they're trying to do them, they don't take anyone with them.
Yeah, and they say that actually Starmer is doing that and will do that. But that wasn't my takeaway from the speech the other day. My takeaway wasn't a line tagged on at the end that, you know, inferred that things would actually get better after a hard couple of years. My takeaway was actually things still look pretty gloomy and there's not much sign of anything really that's going to make people out there in the country feel better anytime soon.
Right, right. And even in the short term, you can, I think, do a slightly better job about saying, yes, this is a difficult decision, but we're doing it for a reason right now. For example, the winter fuel payment cuts. We found out about those in Rachel Reeves's big speech at the end of July. Then a few weeks later, it dribbles out through leaks, first to the FT, then to ourselves at The Guardian, that the government is going to spend some money extending the Household Support Fund, which is a really important fund, which helps local authorities run things like food banks. Now, it would have been relatively easy to package those two decisions together and say, we're taking this really difficult decision over here, which affects pensioners, but we're using some of that money to spend on the poorest in society and make sure they have food banks through the winter. But it just, you know, the communication strategy around that just didn't seem to tie together.
Yeah, and they say, oh, that's because it's a different cohort of people that benefit from the hardship payments. But there is overlap, and it just struck me that it could have been, they could have, you know, limited some of the immediate criticism that they got for example, charities, Age Concern and so on, if they had at the same time as announcing the changes to winter fuel duty, also been slightly more strategic and thought, well, what support are we going to put in place in the months ahead and see if we can kind of, you know, align those two a little bit in people's minds.
Yeah.
And they didn't do that. And I think, you know, maybe that sort of teething problems and the strategy will come with time. Maybe it's the fact that there's a very difficult in tray for them, but it that's just one example of somewhere, I think, where they haven't quite got it right yet. And, you know, we're going to expect to hear more from Rachel Reeves in the next couple of weeks about this side of the party conference season, talking about growth, because I think they've realised that it can't all be about the doom and gloom they're going to inflict to the budget. They also need to do exactly what you mentioned, which is kind of persuade to show people that there is a big vision and there is a sort of an ambition at the end of it all, so that they can explain what, not just why they're making specific choices on specific policies, but try to sort of convey why it's all part of a bigger picture. And that's just missing for me at the moment. And, you know, maybe opportunities like party conference, or before that, Keir Starmer has a speech at the TUC next week. Maybe those are the moments where he can start to sort of paint a bigger picture. But I think they need to do that.
And one final thing, just talking about miserabilism, we also this week learned that the government's thinking of banning smoking in pub gardens and other outdoor public spaces, which has nothing to do with, you know, the difficult problems facing this country, but just shows, I think, where their instincts lie, right?
Yeah, and some of the loudest criticism has, of course, come from the Tory leadership candidates, because let's not forget that during this whole, during the summer, those six Conservative MPs have been up and down the country visiting dozens of Conservative constituency associations ahead of the contest gearing up this week. And as I'm sure all of our listeners will know, because we've had so many Tory leadership contests in recent years, the way it works is that the MPs whittle down the numbers to two, and those final two candidates then go to the country, to the membership in the country, I should say. It's fewer than 100,000 people these days, and they then decide who becomes the next leader of the Conservative Party. There are six candidates, some of whom will be very familiar, not just to Tory members, but also to the public. They include Kayme Badenoch, who was the Trade and Business Secretary, James Cleverly, who was the Foreign, then Home Secretary, and also Priti Patel, a former Home Secretary. And then three who are probably less well-known, even, I think, probably to Tory members, Robert Jenrick, who was the Immigration Minister, who quit over Rishi Sunak's Rwanda plan and not being tough enough on migrant arrivals, Mel Stride, who was Work and Pension Secretary, and also Tom Tugendhat, who was the Security Minister. So the six of them will face their first vote of MPs this week on Wednesday, and one of them will be kicked out. Fast forward a few days, another one will be kicked out of the contest, and they'll be left with four going into Tory party conference. But what have we heard so far? What's grabbed you so far, Kieran, about the contest?
Well, a couple of things. I mean, first of all, I kind of suspect Mel Stride would be the first to get kicked out. Do you remember the last quote that you gave me, by the way, at the end of the summer?
I'm going to say yes, though. No, actually, I did.
Sorry. You gave me a very bullish quote from a Tory leadership candidate, and this was before I think Mel Stride had declared, and then you told me it was Mel Stride, and I couldn't believe it, because I couldn't quite believe Mel Stride was getting into the contest.
Yeah.
But he did get in. I don't think his campaign is
he was an ally of Sunak. Obviously, he's seen as being a centrist Tory, quite moderate.
You know, there's lots of things that were working against him in the eyes of the Tory membership, but he's just not very well known, apart from doing a lot of media during that campaign. So anyway, I think he will probably be the first one out. I think Priti Patel's campaign has slightly disappointed so far. I mean, she is a heavy hitter. I would have expected her to do better. It seems like some of her support seems to be going Robert Jenrick's way. Robert Jenrick is running a much better campaign, I think, than we might have expected.
Well, he's been campaigning for 2 years, hasn't he? When he lost all that weight, he got his hair cut, he quit the government.
Went on the Ozempic, didn't he?
He did.
He says he's not on it now.
But. Yeah. and very slick. He has done a rally today for Tory supporters. Somebody mentioned to me that they were handing out baseball caps with "We want Bobby J" written on it, which I guess is better than his previous nickname, which was Robert Generic.
Yeah.
Which actually, I think, you know, we laugh about it, but it gets to the heart of what I think some of his peers are slightly skeptical about when it comes to Jenrick, in that he was another sort of fairly run-of-the-mill Tory centrist moderate blah 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 blah, who seems to have made this transition, this journey to the right of the party, he says, because of migration and what he saw as immigration minister. But it's quite hard not to think that he hadn't noticed that generally it's the more right wing of the two final two candidates in Tory leadership races that inevitably wins. Boris Johnson did against Jeremy Hunt, and of course Liz Truss did against Rishi Sunak. So, you know, he today at this rally was attacking Labour, suggesting that Reeves's budget would be a declaration of war in the middle classes and that he would provide a tough opposition to Labour. And he's definitely had the most sort of, I think, professional and focused campaign so far. I think they've been putting a lot of effort in, a lot of time in it. And it's been quite, he's been out there, he's visited loads of constituencies. But I think he will find now when they're back at Westminster, and I think we're expecting Kemi Badenoch and James Cleverly to launch their campaigns on Monday, I think he'll find that you know, there'll be a lot more competition and, right, as the race
especially with Kemi Badenoch, who has the tendency to suck all the oxygen out of anything that she's involved in, because all the attention just ends up focused on her. But interestingly, I was talking to one of Robert Jenrick's allies this week, and the person they compared him to was Keir Starmer. Uh-huh. And they said, this is what Starmer did. You know, he tacked to the left to win the leadership and then tacked back to the centre once he'd won it. I mean, the suggestion was, this person was saying, that he'll become the centrist that we thought of him as before if he then wins the contest.
That's not going to convince his right-wing Tory supporters,
is it? No, I don't
think
that's a message that's supposed to be out there, but it was quite an honest conversation.
But what's quite interesting about him, Kemi Badenoch and Priti Patel, is that they are fighting over the future of the right of the Tory party. And obviously, with the spectre of Nigel Farage and reform and looming large over the right of the Tory party, that's something which is taking up a lot of their time. But what we know from Tory leadership contests going way back to, you know, Ian Duncan Smith, is that if any party, and actually it's not just Tory leadership contests, it happened with Labour as well, after election defeat, parties have a tendency to kind of pitch to their extremes. Mm-hmm. That rarely works electorally, even if it makes the party feel better about themselves. Mm-hmm. Because, of course, that age-old adage that elections are won from the centre is true in this country. You need to be able to get a coalition of voters that represent both your core vote but also the political centre in order to be able to get over the line and win a majority. So the three of them seem to be sort of pitching to the right. I think what's going to be interesting about James Cleverly, who of course was Home Secretary, was quite a big beast in the last government, is that he certainly so far seems to be saying that actually it's about winning the next election, and it's about making it clear that it's not just about reuniting the right, it's also about keeping more moderate voters on board, and that warning that the party risks losing a generation of voters in their 20s, 30s, 40s who will leave it forever if they end up looking like they're scrabbling for turf with Nigel Farage.
Yeah, and I think it's been interesting that the acid test of that in this campaign so far has been the question, would you welcome Nigel Farage back into the Tory party? I mean, in a way, it's a silly question because the prospect of that at the moment is fairly distant. But it does just help distill exactly who each of these candidates is. And, I have found it impressive, those who are willing to stand up and say, no, we wouldn't, because we're a different party and we stand for different things.
Yeah, and actually, Priti Patel was quite surprisingly right. firm,
right.
Not just on not letting him back in the party, but when the riots kicked off.
Yep.
And, you know, whose response to the riots was obviously quite controversial, not least because it seemed like he was talking to some of his supporters rather than, you know, Parliament or indeed his constituents more broadly. And she was really very kind of strong on, you know, why his approach was not the right one, and, you know, was not shy in her criticism of him.
But there's a bigger question, I reckon, here, which is, whoever gets elected, do they actually make it through to the next election? Because I think there's a non-negligible chance that this Tory leader only lasts 3 years.
And of course, there's one Tory leadership candidate, and I'm of course talking about Kemi Badenoch, that great fan of The Guardian, who I'm sure is listening in on this podcast, who might not even make it that long. I mean, she's very controversial. She doesn't mind a fight. And lots of her MP colleagues are concerned that actually she's a bit antagonistic, and inevitably there would end up being a whole series of controversies and sort of, you know, angry remarks about different parts of public life, whether it's the BBC or Equality yeah. Rights or whatever. And that isn't necessarily what a party that has spent so many years so divided and obsessed with infighting needs right now in order to rebuild and prove to the country that it's actually changed.
Well, I was talking to a senior Conservative who mentioned that they thought there was a pretty good chance that the Tory leader going into the next election would be Boris Johnson.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I know we keep talking about it, but this person was insisting that Boris wants to come back, that he'd be looking for a seat, and especially if things start to go downhill, as you know, you and I have just been discussing, and I think a lot of Tory MPs are expecting in the next few years, Boris will be there, waiting at the back of the ruck, waiting for the ball to come out, because...
Heard that before, haven't we?
Yeah, he is still not giving up the ghost.
Well, and it is definitely the case that while, and I've been told this by friends of his, that while he's enjoying the millions and the holidays and the big house and the sort of the time to do things like write and not have to, you know, constantly be answering to civil servants and parliament and so on, pesky journalists, he does miss the sort of... the cut and thrust of politics and, I'm told, the limelight.
Yeah.
You know, the status that comes with being prime minister is hard to beat, albeit, you know, one of the hardest jobs out there. And, you know, there is a suggestion that he'd like another chance. So let's watch this space, eh?
Yeah.
How many times have we said that?
I know. Well, either he or Nigel Farage. How about that? They could be the next Tory leader going into the election in 5 years'
Hobson's
time.
Hobson's choice. But let's not get too far ahead of ourselves, Kieran. There's lots of other things happening this week. Of course, Parliament is returning after the summer recess on Monday. We're expecting a big announcement on Ofsted and the way that it grades its inspections of schools. We've got the Grenfell report coming out after all these years. Finally, at the end of this week. And there'll be some legislation going through the Commons as well, both on fiscal responsibility and rail franchising. So there'll be plenty to keep us busy.
Yeah, we're back.
We're back. So that's all from us. Please like and follow Politics Weekly UK to make sure you keep getting our episodes in your feed. John Harris is back on Thursday. This episode was produced by Frankie Toby, music by Axel Kakutier. The executive producer is Maz Ebtahaj. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
This is The Guardian.
In Norway, a woman's boyfriend forgets who she is overnight. In Detroit, a man is arrested, but he was never at the crime scene. In Spain, disturbing pictures of young girls have appeared, and no one knows who's behind them. Something strange is happening. A collision between people and artificial intelligence.
Discover more in The Guardian's series, Black Box. Listen to the whole series right now, wherever you get your podcasts.